This is a production of Cornell University.
UA meeting, March 17th, 2010.
Welcome, everybody. And the first question is, are there any late additions to the agenda? Hearing a rousing chorus of late additions to the agenda, we can move on to what I think is something that we really need to talk a bit about, which is the Child Care Services Committee. And just to bring everybody up to date, we at the Faculty Senate, was it last week? A week ago. A motion came up to establish a committee, an ad hoc committee of the university faculty to try and provide counsel and advice to the child care operation. At least I think I'm summarizing that right. And Ellis pointed out quite strongly, I thought, that this really was a matter that the University Assembly should be worrying about, because the University Assembly represents the constituency, really, of that child care center, namely faculty, students, and staff. And it wasn't, and it isn't simply a faculty matter. It involves the whole community, and that, therefore, is in the province of this group, not the university faculty. In any event, they passed it. And I gather that the Child Services Committee indeed welcomed the intervention of faculty. But I thought that at this meeting we ought to begin by hearing firsthand what some of the problems are. And Brenda Marston very kindly, and I don't think we've ever officially met, very kindly agreed to be with us at some considerable personal inconvenience. To tell us a bit about what's been going on. So, Brenda, thank you so much for coming, and tell us what's up.
Okay. Well, I don't know how much you know about, I don't know how much background you want, but the Child Care Committee formed to have a wide campus voice on input, give input primarily originally when the university was planning the opening of this Cornell Child Care Center. So that was our first very intense work. We started as an ad hoc committee, and then it became an official part of the University Assembly. But we had quite a lot of intense input before the center opened. We really work on the nitty-gritty about what were the teacher ratios, what were the tuition schema that we were going to use, how we were going to handle applications, and whether we were going to set aside a certain number of spots for top-level faculty staff recruits or not. And I think really did a good job setting the vision of the center, which was, I think, supported by human resources, a center that would be a benefit to everyone on campus, students, undergraduates and graduate staff and faculty, and that we wanted it to be open to all those groups, affordable to all those groups. And the vision was that it would be really a place of excellence where any working or studying family could feel fabulous dropping off their kids, could go about their lives, go to their committee meetings, and feel like their kids were in good hands. And we really wanted it to be a place that modeled top-rate early childhood education. And we were pretty well assured that the company Human Resources contracted with Bright Horizons would be able to deliver that. Mm-hmm. And we proceeded. And I think over, the center's been open a year and a half now. It opened nearly fully occupied because there is such a need for infant and toddler care in the area, and everyone was so excited about the idea of having on-site child care. And I don't know, Amy has been on the committee, as I have from the very beginning, and a number of people have. I think we heard conflicting things from, we had some committee members who had children at the center, and we had heard conflicting things about how it was going. And I think, you know, fairly naturally, I think HR at the beginning tended to see problems as individual problems and conveyed that message to us. When we asked why is there such high turnover, they said, well, that's normal at the beginning of the center, or we're hearing that teachers aren't happy with the training they're getting, we're hearing that there's problems with the staff, since they weren't Cornell employees, they're Bright Horizon employees. They had to pay $700 a year to park at a lot right next to the child care center. So our committee did a number of things. We tried to pay attention to how the center was running and how it was getting started. But we also got a lot of pressure from human resources to stop paying any attention to the center once it opened and to move on to other issues, which our general purview is child care for all Cornell students, faculty, not just the ones at the center. So we really have wanted to move on to other issues for people and finding quality after-school care for kids. And a big part of our work has been focused on analyzing the child care grant program, and we made a recommendation last year about how to alter the algorithm for that to give more, substantially more aid to families that were making under $50,000 a year at Cornell. And we felt like really we need to put our priorities in helping lower income families get more financial assistance, because that's really, it keeps them from getting quality care for their kids. So anyway, that's what our committee's been working on. We were really shocked when in January, Linda Cole Howell from HR came to us and reported the results of a parent satisfaction survey that HR conducted. And I think what they said is that they were hearing enough complaints from parents that they felt like they couldn't just take what Bright Horizons was telling them as fact. They needed to do their own survey. So I'm really glad they did that. And the results were really horrible on just about every level. I mean,
that was this January?
Yes, just a couple months ago. And I'll just run through a few things. The teacher turnover at the center, as we thought, was higher than normal. But in a year and a half, 22 teachers have left. That far exceeds even what Bright Horizons admits is acceptable.
And what percentage is
that? Well, how many teachers are there? There's 150 kids there, so there's probably 50 staff. Yeah.
So 30% turnover.
Yeah, I can give you the links to the whole.
Just looking for it.
Yeah, 22.
Yeah, I know.
There's 200.
Yeah.
You know.
And then on top of it, both Bright Horizons and Human Resources were saying that the exit interviews indicate these people are leaving just for personal reasons. They have career opportunities, or they're moving and stuff like that. But when you see these kinds of numbers, they start to speak for themselves. And I think an underlying story is that staff feel very mistreated there. They don't feel like they have a voice. And a lot of people are resigning because they're so frustrated with the magnitude of the problems there. Teachers don't have control over their supply budget for their room. They have trouble buying tape and glue and stuff like this. And teachers feel very scrutinized. The other really shocking result of this survey is the number of incidents reported to the State Office of Children and Family Services. Our center is just off the chart. In this period, the other major child care center, IC3, had 4 violations reported. IACC had 4. Even the drop-in center, which is a place that kind of operates more on a shoestring and it has, you know, more challenges, they had 14 violations. Cornell Child Care Center had 38 violations, 17 of them serious. None of the other centers had any serious violations. So it raises 2 concerns. It's like, what is going on there? You know, are there, what kind of serious violations are occurring at the center, and how could this be happening? And what is the culture that's allowing this to happen? And a lot of people feel like part of it is a culture of over-reporting, so that teachers are getting reported if they leave the wipes with bleach on the changing table when they're changing the kid, and, you know, it's supposed to be off the table, you know, and someone's watching and they write it up. So there's some concern that not only is there over-reporting, but that then it initiates this whole punitive process that the teachers have to undergo. And a number of teachers, really well-respected teachers in the community, resigned finally after going through this humiliating process, which they call progressive counseling, that's supposed to be designed to encourage employees to take responsibility for quality workplace. Well, anyway, we just at our last meeting had a Bright Horizons representative come and talk to us, and it really does sound like there are some serious problems with their management style. And I think, Lynette Chapel Williams came and spoke to us at our February meeting, and she said that HR also feels like Bright Horizons performance has been substandard. Cornell has a 5-year contract with them, and I think Bright Horizons realizes that contract is in jeopardy of not being renewed if they don't change things around. Bright Horizons has come up with an action plan that they shared with us at our meeting yesterday. But anyway, things were at such an alarming level that parents have started taking their kids out of the center, and we really felt alarmed that it would have long-lasting repercussions if the center is plagued with such a negative reputation from the beginning, that it's going to be the opposite of what we want. We want it to be a place everyone's clamoring to get into, and instead it's a place that faculty and people who have other choices are pulling their kids out and hiring nannies to have their kids at home. So we're really, really surprised and disappointed. Everything on this long survey case, okay, not everything. There were a few bright spots, like people thought the facility was nice. Yeah. But on the issues of communication with parents, the curriculum, the physical activity, they don't allow it. They make it very hard for teachers to take their kids on field trips and get out. Oh, it's just pretty much the opposite of what we all want. What happened, you know, the level of the problem there really came as a surprise, although we were hearing some indications of it along the way. And one of the new members on our committee is Steve Morgan, who's the person who suggested the Faculty Senate ad hoc committee as a way to approach it. The reason we support it is because we've worked with Steve, and he's a member of our committee, and we feel like their intention isn't, I mean, to me, the politics of who has jurisdiction aren't really important. What was important is here was a group of people who were committed and had the initiative and were willing to jump in, roll up their shirt sleeves, and work in a really intense way to come up with a report and recommendations by early next fall. So they are going to act very quickly, they're going to pull together faculty who are experts on child care. And part of our goal from the beginning was of this center was that it be a very Cornell specific child care center, and that the curriculum and practices there be informed by the best research that's being done here at Cornell about early childhood education. So we support the idea of Cornell's own experts on child care coming in and giving support. We also felt like at this point, our committee still has a voice on this issue, and we feel like we'll be collaborating with them and we can make our own recommendations, but we felt like it would be useful to have a committee that is working independently and not having representatives of HR at their meetings. They could basically go come up with what they think are the issues and recommendations and get back to us on it. So that's why we moved really quickly to bring this to your attention and to give our recommendation that we support the formation of this ad hoc committee to deal with this close to a crisis situation that really needs a response. I mean, because there are families and children at that center. We feel like we really need things to change quickly. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard things like this about the center, you know, as much as 2-3 months ago, not the reports of the survey, but from parents there whose opinions I trust. I guess I was really puzzled and voted against the resolution in the Senate for that reason. Here is the person who's on our committee who's saying we haven't done our job, basically. That's my take on it. We didn't do our job. This thing has come up and we need to sort of form another committee to do it. My intuition and the discussion was cut off so that we couldn't have a really more full discussion. Somebody did bring up, however, if this is a crisis, why do we have to do something about it in the fall? By the fall, we have a committee. The committee has HR representatives on it. I mean, I was a little puzzled by your last statement that we don't want a committee with HR on it, when in fact HR is the one. I was on that committee when it was debating whether Bright Horizons would get the contract. We didn't have a vote in it. HR did. So my feeling is, if you're trying to do something, and first of all, you're waiting till fall to do it, and
They're
not
waiting until fall. The
well,
report
needs
to be done by fall. They're going to start working
in
the spring and over.
You're waiting until fall to formulate the response that the report will be based. That it will be based on the report. That's what I'm saying. I mean, something could be done if it was a crisis through a committee by just getting people together who are on the committee and pushing some kind of either resolution through us to say, I mean, unless the feeling was, well, nothing can get done without the faculty doing it. I mean, it seemed to me that's the consequence of what happened. Instead of, now, I could be wrong, it could be that 55 faculty members or whoever is going to be, you know, voted for this are going to say, we're going to get this done, and they'll drum up a really very strong report. And it'll go to the administration. The administration will take several months to decide about it, maybe half a year. And they'll say, well, we'll give Bright Horizons a chance. Bright Horizons has a little more time and blah, blah, blah. That's not a response to a crisis. The response to the crisis would be bring a resolution to us, an emergency resolution, if nothing else. We pass an emergency resolution which says to the president, you have a month to respond to this. There's a crisis at the center. There's abuse going on. I mean, all these charges that were in the same group. Remarkable, especially when the charges were coupled with a rehash of history, which says that a grave injustice was done in the first place by getting these people over IAC, or was IACC, right? That was all in the resolution.
IC3.
That was my take on it. Now, my point on my feeling about it now is that, you know, the committee will do something and all the better. If it turns out good, that's great. But what could be done is we could take a recommendation from your committee and draft something even stronger than the faculty senate resolution, based on your recommendations, that there be an immediate immediate cut of the contract with Bright Horizons, period, if those things are true.
Well, as Lynette pointed out, of course, the university would suffer financially.
Who are Bright Horizons? Is this a national
corporation?
National corporation that runs lots of daycare centers, including several at academic institutions. It was founded by Cornell alumni, and HR thought that we might get some successes to get some special treatment.
President Scorton talked to their CEO and have something.
Well, after they signed the contract, it was taken over by, I don't know, a hedge fund or something. Bain.
Really?
Yeah, Bain, which is a Cornell, you know, basically Cornell run agency. Anyway, Mike.
I can join in. If this is a crisis, if our kids are getting substandard care, I mean, not just adequate care that's potentially overreported and there's problems to be worked through.
Right.
If there is actual, this is a substandard daycare, then Cornell wouldn't enter into a contract this big without having escape clauses. Mm-hmm. But if they don't,
right.
The financial cost is water under the bridge to getting it running right. So, the committee either thinks they can be rehabilitated to a certain level immediately, and the best practices from Cornell Education will be worked in starting in the fall, or they do not. And if they do not, then I would propose exactly that emergency resolution, and potentially up to validating the charges and potentially severing or penalizing the contract, and moving forward. It's just a matter of there's where we want it to be, there's where it is, and there's the level of acceptability and whether they are at least that high or can get there quickly. And if not, then we have an obligation to act regardless of what the faculty senate might choose to do or in concert with them. I personally, politics aside, if there's a one of the four committees who wants to champion a cause, I'm all for lending a hand if they've already picked up the gauntlet. I wish they would use the structures that were designed so there's not a lot of rework, but I'd be glad to join your effort, but it really is a matter of, does the committee think they are at an acceptable level of child care, or we're waiting for an actual harm, not just a violation, but that somebody could, materially be negatively affected, which is far more damaging and something we would all want to avoid.
You know, my sense is that the feedback is that kids aren't in physical danger, but they're in emotional and developmental danger from the fact of some kids have had 10 teachers in their year at the center, and just the whole issue of attachment and disruption and not knowing who's going to be their teacher.
So that's what makes it ugly.
Yeah.
Whether they're meeting the margin line or not is in the eye of the beholder and is a little bit subjective.
Yeah.
So who, perhaps the committee or, I'm sorry, could give us a benchmark with which to, is this a crisis or just a grave concern that is being worked?
I would say it's the latter.
I mean,
at this point, I think Bright Horizons has owned the problems that have happened. They underestimated how things would go, and they've admitted to that. There are directors and there are regional directors who are coming to the center and spending large amounts of time during the week and on weekends training staff. They put a very, very rigorous and lengthy action plan in process, and they are working on it. So I do feel like it's...
And you have confidence to take their word, that they have the ability to pull this off. I mean, of course, I've said in my head, HR is witness, all we've seen, not all the centers are great. I am on the case. You know, do we believe it? And when's their first report card to see that there has been change?
So I very much like the idea that, you know, we need to be proactive in reviewing this. In support of what Amy said, I was actually late because I was talking to a friend of mine that I ran into on Tower Road who has a daughter at Bright Horizons. And she said that had I asked her a month ago, she was ready to take her daughter out of Bright Horizons and go down to, what is it, TC3 or something, IC3. She said that since then, she's starting to see improvements. She's met with the director. She says that they have, like Amy said, that they're owning up to the problem, But whether or not they do actually solve the problem, I think, is but she said that she is starting to see changes, and right now she at least is keeping her daughters there. So
they've made a lot of positive strides in the last couple of months since January, since the parent survey was sold this month.
Okay. Who are they reporting to?
Bright Horizons reports to Lynette and Mary Offerman. I mean, right? Is that the way it works?
So have they been given a charge to correct whatever these deficiencies are, and somebody is watching them, requiring that they turn in reports and be reviewed?
Yes, they have. This is their action plan that they shared with us yesterday. And I think that Lynette and Mary are taking it seriously at this point. They've also asked the committee to come back to focusing on the child care center temporarily until...
Well, it's HR 101 to develop a corrective action plan, get the other side to sign it, and then to measure their progress against the plan and the timelines were given. And that's when you have the ability to break a contract, you know, and you're on the right side of the law, so to speak, if there's a lawsuit, because you give them the chance, you know, and you have the progress reports. So if they're following their own HR guidelines, if, you know, the question is, have they done that? I know they're discussing it. It sounds like we think they have, but we're not quite sure what form or format or reportables, and perhaps we can request that confirmation information.
Okay, well, this has been a great dialogue. I'm glad about Amy's comment that it's not a crisis. And then I want to go back to this question of whether this was a political bureaucratic thing, because that was what was characterized as our lack of support of it, the resolution or a tabling of it. You see, I think it's really discouraging to what effort we're trying to make as an assembly. And this isn't politics at all. This is simply a matter of how power is diffused. Maybe that's political across the university, and responsibilities are taken. If this is all going to be, you know, big issue generated, in fact, the Senate faculty get behind and stuff, and then the whole reason why the committee was formed gets, which is to be an effective implementer of policies and suggesters of policies. That's what the committee was about. It wasn't, you know, and that gets undermined by this action, which says that we form these committees, but the committees are not important until there's a crisis of some sort or some difficulty, and then we form another committee to do something about it. My feeling is that I think your committee ought to take a strong action right now and move faster than the Senate committee, because that will prove that it's a valuable committee, that it has a reason for being there other than just talking about, you know, talking amongst yourselves. That, from my point of view, has been the major problem with this. That is, this issue should have been earlier in front of us. That may be our problem, our responsibility. We didn't have a representative that came there enough. On the other hand,
earlier, when, I mean, as far as the way things work at Cornell, this is pretty damn fast, frankly.
Well, it is. I'm not faulting. You know, I guess it's that it came to us. It came to us. Why did it come to the Senate in January? You know, the Senate before it came to us.
It came to you at your last meeting before the Senate meeting.
Well, it came to us as a fait accompli. This
was already brought to the Senate.
It was already headed to the Senate. It was that, do we endorse this? I'm not talking about politics or jurisdiction here or bureaucracy. In fact, I'm trying to get around bureaucracy. More committees is more bureaucracy. We have a committee. Let's do something with it.
I like your idea of moving and taking action on that. I don't agree that our committee's been slow to communicate or ineffective, frankly. I think it's been a very effective committee. And you've seen the resolutions that you passed the resolutions we've sent up to you, and they've made their way to the president, who's responded to them. So I take issue with that characterization.
Okay, well, I think the issue really is what does it make sense to do at this point, and how should we proceed in the most effective way? And clearly one of the difficulties was that the first we knew of this problem was the motion supporting the establishment of a faculty committee, and the general reaction around the room was, well, why? I mean, what, you know, because we didn't have enough of the context, I felt, to understand it. So now we're faced with a situation where clearly things have been very unsatisfactory as measured by a formal survey done by HR. That's the data which says things are not good, and there's lots of other supporting information. HR says they're working on it. Bright Horizon says they're working on it. Is there anything useful we can do in the meantime to expedite this? It seems to me that a motion that says Bright Horizons is a bunch of idiots is not helpful at this point. Should we simply stand by, or is there something useful that we could do to expedite this process? Can we put any pressure on HR to see that things happen more expeditiously? You know, what are your thoughts? You're closer to it than any of us.
My own thoughts, you know, not representing the committee, are that
University Assembly Meeting, March 17th, 2010. The first part of the meeting was not included in this recording.
Exciting item, the approval of the minutes from 2:24:10. Everybody I know has read the minutes carefully and perused them. Good. Is there any problems?
I want to commend the 40 minutes. Thank you very much. They're really well done.
Do I hear any additions or corrections? Hearing none, I declare the minutes approved. Okay, this brings us to committee updates from all University Assemblies committees. I hate to think how many there are. And if each one takes 5 minutes, we'll be here all night.
Well, I'll make them short, mine at least. So Beth McKinney was unable to come, but she sent me a little bit of information. So she's reporting on the child care subcommittee. She said there's 15 active members meeting monthly, and that their recent resolutions and actions have included that they presented President Scorton with a statement supporting work-life balance at Cornell. They've presented 3 resolutions approved and sent to the UA from the child care subcommittee. These were on affordability of child care, computer use at Cornell's Child Care Center, and the Child Care Center concerns. And recent work includes becoming experts on the areas such as flex in the workplace, elder care, tenure clock stop, and increased communication about existing work family life programs. So that's report. As far as TAC, TAC has not yet met this one, transportation.
Thank you.
Transportation committee. But I mentioned the last time the most notable thing is that they are making significant progress on the vanpool program. So this is in line with having fewer people drive their own personal cars and figuring out alternative transportation. So again, keep spreading the word on this. I've seen that they've posted some flyers in various buildings around campus. Basically, they've simplified the payment structure for this, making it easier. You need fewer people to start up a van. Payment is based more on distance away rather than number of people in the van. So it's a much more simple system for people to organize. And additionally, they're helping match people in the van. So if you know anybody that wants to but might not have friends that live in the same area, they're helping to place people together. And Big Red Bikes also is a program which is the Undergraduate Student Assembly has put funding for, and this is going, by all accounts, full steam forward. And I know that the issue has come up with the Graduate Professional Student Assembly to look at for next year as well to get involved. So this is a program that you might see rolled out very, very soon.
Marty?
Van pool, I looked into that, and there's a sort of minimum distance that it's active in. I think it's 10 miles or something like that, right?
Probably. I don't know what the exact is. So again, this is going through a third party contractor. This is a company.
Right, I know. I wrote them and I asked them and they said, no, we don't have anybody because we don't deal within 10 miles.
Yeah.
So it would strike me that there might be a useful way. I mean, it used to be ride pooling or something like that that they could come up with, which is not to a, you know.
The past 2 years. And it's an item that would, I think, help the Cornell community a lot by encouraging donations to not-for-profit student housing that isn't owned by the university. So it's kind of a very small niche, but nonetheless important aspect of the university community. And so this would encourage donations to that. And Mark Fontana, who a lot of you know, has been working on this. So various levels, and he's met with President Thornton and so forth, so he can probably talk about it in much greater detail than I can.
Sure. I guess the easiest way to do this, I usually do this in the capacity of meeting in the kind of congressional office, so I apologize if I kind of go into lobbying mode right now as I start to describe this. It would essentially allow all non-university-owned, not-for-profit student housing entities to use tax-deductible donations in order to make infrastructural improvements. The way the tax law is currently written, those entities can only use tax-deductible donations for purely scholastic purposes. And they do this by square footage of the house, so if they determine, you know, 20% of this house is used for, quote, scholastic purposes, they can only use tax-deductible donations directly towards that purpose. They're not allowed to put in fire prevention equipment with that kind of money, et cetera. One of the problems with a lot of these sort of housing entities is that they're old. This is especially the case with fraternities and sororities, where the houses have been around for sometimes literally 100 years. I think the way that the reason President Thornton has endorsed this is, you know, quite logically, without those housing entities, and I understood, John, what you were saying with, you know, it's a small niche group, but at the same time, I mean, at Cornell, knowing that a third of students are a part of fraternities and sororities, and probably at one point lived in them, it's actually pretty a sizable percentage of people who rely on this sort of housing. And if it were not for those housing entities, Cornell in some way would have to make up the difference in housing. Usually when we talk about this more on the federal level, the argument goes that public schools then even have to spend more money for building dorms. The interesting thing about this bill is it's scored at only, and I say only here, I mean we're talking millions still, but $148 million over 10 years, which comparative to most of the legislation before our Congress right now is literally chump change. This would benefit directly over 250,000 students as opposed to building a new dorm, which can cost $50 million in and of itself. So I guess my kind of strategy here, I tend to meet with the legislative offices from New York State, is to be able to kind of present first from President Thornton, which is useful, but I think even more useful coming from this body as kind of a wide representation of the university and knowing kind of Cornell's place in New York State, et cetera. That's why I'm looking for the support, I suppose. So
what does this do? I mean, what you're asking us to support a resolution. Where does this resolution go?
This is currently before the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate.
Right, but supposing we
sure.
approve this, our chain of command is then we forward this to the President and asking him to say that he's in favor of it,
right,
from the university's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And he already has said he's in favor of it.
Right. My concern really, I know he supports it. What I think is very valuable is to have a cross-section of our community show that they are also in support of it. That in and of itself, you know, walking into an office and saying, you know, look, our president supports this, you know, has only so much meaning. I'm a student, usually I'm with another student. We can kind of sort of explain a student perspective on it. But to say an assembly which is composed of all of the constituencies of Cornell understands not only the fact that this would be advantageous, but sort of understands the opportunity costs involved when it comes to student housing and how this allows college to be more affordable to a lot of people.
Thank you.
Sure.
Right.
I wondered whether the one-third of members of Cornell students are fraternity and sorority members. Mm-hmm. What portion of that third actually live in fraternities? First question.
So a very rough estimate, usually sophomores and juniors in fraternities, and usually sophomores in sororities.
So it's
so it, it
20, how many, 30,000 students in Cornell?
3,800
of those portions. What I get, what I'm getting at is this only for housing, or does it be any building which is not for profit that provides? I mean, like for example, they're eating clubs too, right?
Student, it's. The classification is a bit subtle in the tax code, and I'm not going to pretend that I understand the subtleties of it. However, that being said, the phrase that they've had us memorized that covers it all is non-university-owned, not-for-profit student housing entities.
And so, if a fraternity, are there fraternities and sororities that do not house students, but have them as union clubs, like in Princeton? No. Everybody houses. So that any fraternity and sorority then, and other things, I suppose, college houses.
It, a lot, and the other thing is the reason, I mean, fraternities and sororities happen to be the ones leading this charge because we just have the greatest numbers, so you have a bit of a kind of a collective good problem here.
Right.
But this also covers things like Hillel and other such organizations. So yeah, it does reach a bit longer.
Okay, and then the funds that are donated can be used to improve the whole building.
Right.
Not just the housing portion.
Correct. And if you actually look at the legislation, the first year which we were lobbying this, I wasn't part of the efforts at that point, but Congressman specifically said, oh, so great, you're going to go buy fitness equipment and things like that. And there's specifically a clause written in there that that's not what the money is used for. It's for retrofitting houses. It's for that sort of thing.
A better kitchen? A better bar? Better.
No, again, the language of the bill is written such that it is clear the sorts of
right.
acceptable uses of that
sort of thing. And you are next, I think.
Yeah, you know, non-university owned, not-for-profit occurs to me as, I think, student agencies, but they are not strictly student housing, although they do have some student housing. There's also retail space and office space.
Mm-hmm.
What is the, and there's other entities too, what is the amount of student housing percentage for the building required to be able to fall into this? Is there any, is it 20% of the building?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure of the exact answer to it. Again, I think this is the classification scheme is the one that the tax code uses, and needless to say, that is something that is complex to the point of most people not understanding it, including myself. So it wouldn't do any justice for me to sit here and pretend to know what I'm talking about when it
perfectly,
comes to that.
Yeah.
But so yeah, I don't know.
What, Alice? Why would one be against this here at the university? Right now, if there are donors out there saying, damn, I'd like to really improve the fire system in my old fraternity, mm-hmm. but gee, it's not tax exempt, I'm not going to give the money, then since that has to meet code, that money has to come from somewhere else. What's wrong with that? I don't see anything wrong with this.
I
mean, why would anyone particularly be against this, except that it's going to cost $150? I mean, from the point of view of the university,
sure.
What are the arguments against this?
There aren't a whole lot of them. The thing that the resistance that we face is because it's a very small bill, the challenge, this can never get to the floor of the House of the Senate on its own. It's just too small. It's inconsequential in that regard. You have to find a larger piece of legislation to kind of have it ride on to. And
tell him Mike Arcieri. Tell him, put this on the bill.
I'm
and,
he's Dean
and...
That's
and
one of the things that we've been thinking about, too. The bill was actually passed in the House of Representatives in 2003 in what was known as the Charitable Giving Act of 2003. During Commerce Committee, it got pulled out for various political reasons, of which I'm not entirely certain myself.
So we need to draft a resolution.
Well, we have
a resolution. Well,
Don has done this.
That.
Sorry.
There's more discussion. Andrew, you...
I move the resolution.
Emily.
Emily, I'm sorry.
Does that cover co-op housing?
I believe it would. I'm not...
Yeah.
No reason why I wouldn't, but
right.
Again, not
well,
entirely
my understanding would be... It would just come down to whether who owns the student, the only person, because if it's already university, who owns the co-op? Because if it's already university owned, then that's already something covered. But if the co-ops are independent organizations, then yeah, this would be something that this would help.
Okay.
Is there people ready to vote on this?
I have a motion for the resolution.
You move the resolution. There's a second. There's a second. Any further discussion? All in favor of the resolution, please raise your hand. Okay. All opposed? All abstaining? All who aren't members and don't wish to have anything to do with it. Okay, it passes unanimously.
I appreciate that.
All right, this brings then items from the floor, and Ed has already mentioned that he found something on the floor.
Yeah, so I just wanted to sort of test the body's opinion on something, whether or not to write a resolution to this, just to kind of start some conversation. So at the last graduate professional student assembly voting body meeting, there was a resolution for the GPSA to establish its own environmental sustainability committee. And this is, the University Assembly has its own environmental sustainability committee.
We endorse that in our committee.
Yeah, so since you bring that up, you know, you mentioned earlier that more committees is just more bureaucracy.
Yeah.
So it's just my feeling is I wasn't exactly pleased that our committee endorsed the formation of another committee without bringing it through the University Assembly.
Oh, okay.
Just as a chain of command thing. I mean, again,
that's bureaucracy.
So when it came to the University Assembly, or not to the Graduate Professional Student Assembly, like personally, I would have voted against it, not because I think it's a bad idea, just because it didn't come through the University Assembly for endorsement and vetting whether or not this was a good idea or if there was another way to adjust the graduate student interest. So basically, this comes out of a lot of graduate students have interest in sustainability, and there was a lot of interest in joining the University Assembly Sustainability Committee. And so what a really long way of saying, would there be any interest in upping the number of graduate student seats because of the overwhelming interest in sustainability on the University Sustainability Committee from one seat to, say, something like three seats? And then maybe using this instead of forming another committee on top of committees, and then we keep the power more centralized to this committee and administration, those people listen to, with people like that. Does that make sense? So more seats for graduate students?
Well, even without that, for this body to endorse duplication of a committee we already have is almost admitting that our committee is impotent, and we require the GPSA to have its own committee.
So this brought
that's
up
nonsense.
And that's why I was
nonsense, because we were at the debate when it was brought up, and it was brought up because GPSA has a strong, active membership in this committee, and that they are accomplishing things that the University Assembly Committee, is not in a position to do, because they have a full agenda and are doing lots of things. It was felt that the representative on our committee from GPSA always going back and forth and talking with the local committee. Same thing happens with the Student Assembly Committee. There are several Student Assembly. I mean, maybe I should have given my Sustainability Committee report, because we've been talking about these things.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't felt that this was something. The letter was a letter of support, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a resolution, because we committees don't get resolutions, I think. Maybe it was a resolution.
It was signed by everybody, and
yeah,
it was presented to us that everybody
supported
it. And
what we were saying was, you're doing great work. We want to keep continue to have representation. What you're doing represented to us, coordinating things. We can, in fact, what we've tried to do. This is part of the report from the Sustainability Committee, so that we're active. We've been trying to coordinate all the different, there are like 30 sustainability related
mm-hmm.
organizations, student and otherwise, on campus. And we said, let's bring them together in a forum, because we have Earth Month weekday coming up. And we got together a group and had, it's going to be coordinated, their activities for that period will be coordinated through the Center for Sustainable Futures. I don't think it's right to say that we were losing power because there are 20 different groups interested in sustainability. We have a role, and our role is to do some coordinating. Our role is also to develop policies. It's stated in our charge, for campus-wide. and to do, conduct inquiries into practices going on in different divisions of the university, you know, buildings and otherwise. And we're busy doing that. So I don't feel there's any loss of power in this sense. If you want to contrast it with what was happening there, it's reasonable to do that. What was happening there was our committee wasn't on top of this issue, or it said the only way to get on top of this is to start another committee separate from this, and that bothered me about that. I think it's a different situation entirely. And as far as impotent is concerned, I mean, you're only impotent if you don't do anything. Well, I mean, that's only one sign of impotence.
Well, however, you don't know you're impotent until somebody tests you to see if you're impotent.
Well,
and all the tests that we have had recently show that we're impotent. You know, when our chair has to stand up and admit that he was totally ignorant about the child care situation in front of the entire faculty, that's because the university assembly is impotent. It sucks.
Yeah.
You know, I pushed for years and years. We should push to try and establish ourselves.
Right.
And every time I turn around,
right,
as I wrote you, Charlie, you know, there's some other committee. So we don't even get reports from our own committee.
Right, right. Well,
they're sending resolutions without coming to us first. They're not supposed to send their own resolutions to anybody without going to us first. They're our committee. The Family Services, the Child Care Committee, is a subcommittee of the... She's not there anymore.
Right.
She shouldn't come to us and tell us that they sent resolutions off without coming to us first. The only power they have is from the Family Services Committee, which is our committee.
Right. And now you're on that committee, so you can tell
them. No, I assure you, I will make sure that as you find out what's going on.
In this case, it's not a problem from my point of view. I should also say that this committee was set up with a very flexible and open membership.
Yep.
And we don't need to appoint three people. The GBSA can suggest three or four people. And we can just put on. Period.
Okay.
We don't even have to vote on.
Didn't
mean
to point it. Well, yeah. Can I chime in here so I can be all that, you know, for a reason?
Huh? Hi.
Oh, hi. Mike Walsh. I'm one of two student trustees for those who don't know me. I've also been involved as the graduate student representative to the President's Climate Commitment Implementation Committee. And this has been the group that's been charged with kind of developing a plan for Cornell to achieve climate neutrality, but also address, you know, the overarching issue of sustainability here at the university. And there's work in the works right now is a transition from developing the climate action plan, which you were all presented to on back in October or September, to actually doing stuff, to actually trying to be engaged in being more sustainable at the operating campus. And we're going to be, I think, kicking off sometime during Earth Day month week, a President's Sustainable Campus Committee. So this is now another, you know, university-wide sustainability committee, focus committee. And I've been trying to talk with Dan Roth and Burt Land and Ecos, you know, about where we want to take this and what is the best use of our committee structure, of our governance structure, and you know, try and make sure that efforts are not duplicated and messages are clear across the board. And what we're concerned about, or what I'm personally concerned about right now, and I've expressed to Chairman Strong there, is that there's a proliferation of groups, you know, focused on sustainability now, and it's just diffusing our talent. You know, people are going to all these extra meetings, and these groups are not communicating too well. I've been working with students over the past 2 years trying to get, you know, some of these student groups to focus more on, you know, strategically, you know, developing plans on how they can work not only on one single project a year, but work, you know, over a longer period of time and build succession planning within their organizations so that they can establish, actual plans that they can get done. And, you know, one of my concerns is there's way too many groups, and I've been trying to get them to work together. I've held, you know, with the Sustainability Hub, two sustainability summits right now to get some of our student groups working together. And it's clear right now, from my perspective, that there's just too much going on. And some of these groups are very specific with what they focus on, and some of them are very vague. And what I think what really needs to happen is, you know, from both the assembly system as a whole and the central administration, specifically Q Wang and Tim Fahey, who are now the chairs of the President's Sustainable Campus Committee, is really trying to delineate what needs to get done at the university in terms of sustainability, rather than having
you know, X number of, you know, sustainability, you know, four separate, you know, three or four separate sustainability committees that, you know, may or may not be talking to each other. And so the concern is that the GPSA is trying to form its own sustainability committee. And it has gotten some stuff done collaborating with other groups. But it hasn't, you know, yet really focused on some of the specific stuff that the GPSA needs to get done in terms of making its, you know, byline funding process more sustainable, how these student groups basically use money on campus, making sure these student groups are more sustainable. And that's one area that it can get done. And I'm very supportive of them working on that. But I'm just concerned that their mandate that they just wrote for themselves, that they kind of perceived that they got from the University Sustainability Committee, is to work on kind of these university-wide sustainability projects again. And my worry is that it's just another group that's out there that labels sustainability, but is just confused as to its entire role in the university.
Okay. So you said this to them, and they said, we're not confused, or did they say, yes, we are confused, thank you.
So it was.
So my point in saying this is that it was presented to us by our representative Fred Cowers on both committees and on CPSA, and his feeling is that they're doing good work and they just need to, you know, feel some sense of coherence, cohesion, and they are. I guess given the things that they're doing, which are independent of what our committee does. If they're doing something, why would we say, oh, you can't do that under that name, you have to do it under another committee name?
But they
not to cut you guys off, but
I
just wanted to sort of broach this as something for people to think about. You know, we can continue these conversations. So in light of what Mike has said, that, you know, the university is going to be looking at how it coordinates sustainability committees and who it listens to.
No, actually, that's not the message I got from Dan Roth about the University Sustainability Committee that Kiwan is involved in.
I mean, they're obviously going to need to know.
They're not going to be coordinating all the sustainability groups.
No, they're not. They're going to be coordinating sustainability efforts on campus, operational efforts.
Not the different groups.
So
that's a very big difference.
So I just wanted to mention it. You may see from me at the next meeting something proposing increasing the number of graduate students on
this. You don't have to.
Well, I mean, the thought, yeah, just to let you guys know that this is going to happen. I want to see that if this is acceptable, and then that way I can propose it to the graduate professional student assembly people who drafted this as sort of another avenue to go through that the university assembly would support
to them setting up a committee.
To setting up a committee that looks at university-wide issues. We may do our own that focuses inwardly, but instead of one that focuses on university-wide issues.
If you come to the university sustainable committee meeting next one and propose this is a problem, and Mike, you're perfectly welcome to come to one also.
I think part of the problem is that what this group has done, some of the stuff that you cited, they have done well, but it's best placed in the context of a wider university effort. You know, one of the things that this group, you know, the GPSA group has brought forth is LIHTC Cornell. That's not a grad student specific issue. That's not an undergraduate specific issue. That's not an employee specific issue. That's not a faculty. It's a university wide issue. And these things need to be presented in the correct context and in a very much more efficient context.
So with that, if you don't mind, call the meeting.
I have one question.
Then we'll listen.
We spoke, and I'm not sure if you covered this at the meeting or missed, but we spoke about adding to the balance of all the different constituent assemblies the charter changes we wanted to make.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that wasn't on the student assembly election ballot.
It was proposed to go on the ballot for students, faculty, and staff. It'll go on this trustee election ballot, which is full undergrads. And actually, on that note, please help get the information out to undergrads.
Yeah. Undergrads. Do you think 20% of the undergraduate community is going to vote in the graduate trustee election?
It's going to be very difficult. So it's a student trustee election.
I know, but it's a graduate.
So please help us get.
So please
help us get the information out that. A, they should be voting for trustee, but there's also other important
things.
I
will try.
Please do. Yeah.
Logistical.
Motion to extend the meeting by 5 minutes?
Oh, God, I hope not.
Well, what time?
1 minute.
one minute.
Go ahead.
logistical reason, if you go under the UA charter, the amendment procedure predates the existence of GPSA, so it calls for a referendum of all students. It doesn't distinguish between grad and undergrad.
So it's 20% of students.
So the, yeah.
Okay.
So the most logical way to implement that seemed to be to tack it on to the one student-wide election that's happening this year, which is the student trustee.
Mike, do you know if anyone's challenging that up?
I don't think in the undergraduate student trustee election there was 20% turnout last time. It might have been very close.
Well, if we don't get it, we'll have to figure out another way. But anyhow, Jim, did you have something? Or?
Groups around campus and under the Big Four and other things that are doing great things are going to spring up all the time. They do not need to be part of the university system per se unless they want to be. In other words, how many groups are there across the nation fighting cancer, doing cancer research? You know, people have an interest. They might, you know, they call themselves a group and they do that. What they need to know is what value we bring and how they can communicate issues. You know, when they hit a certain level of, we've been saying this and nothing's happening. We have a committee that might be able to help.
Yeah.
So, you know, we send the offer of friendship if they get educated. And just because they want to form a committee, well, great. Whatever they can do will be better than it was.
But better liaise with
as far as diffusing the kind of like when we get to the faculty senate type issues, is resolution shouldn't be going to President Sporton for university-wide things that haven't gone through that process, and that's their inroad, and they need to know that so that they use the proper process. And likewise, discipline from President Scorton's level of routing it, or his people routing it, if it comes, you know, through the wrong path. And if we need a resolution or some sense to reaffirm that to the Faculty Senate, the University Employee Assembly, and others about, you know, for certain levels of matters, there is a process, and that the chairman and people should be talking to make sure that we speak with one voice, that maybe that needs to be re-blued in light of some of the issues we're trying to tackle. The other that Randy just mentioned to me was, we have gotten to a point of saying we wanted to see Lynette and Mary Opperman as soon as can be arranged, and then it seemed like we kind of infused and went into the subcommittee going to put forth the resolution. I want to clarify, are we expecting you to go and set up a meeting as soon as possible with those people with the University Assembly so that we can face-to-face, you know, convey to them that this is a concern to us and get a sense that they are on the ball, or do we want to wait for the report?
I
think the best thing we can do is show a sense of urgency to this and make sure that they're acting, and that does no harm, but also puts up on their priorities if they're not already there.
So the exec committee sets agendas, but we're informed by whatever. But does that sound like something everybody wants? Invite Lynette and all right.
And you have to do it.
Yeah.
And,
all right.
Did we hear anything on our two outstanding resolutions from the?
Not aware that we have.
Mike can report that our sustainability one, apparently there's some effort to introduce that into the strategic plan.
There's a whole section in the new draft of the strategic plan on sustainability.
Okay, so that resolution has some consequences.
So I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
There's food.
Oh, he's in there? Never mind. Oh, is that
left? Forget it. We should do this.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.